What's up and welcome to a brand new episode of the SBL podcast. Today, I sit down with the incredible Steve Jenkins. If you don't know Steve Jenkins, check out this artist list. I have it written down right here. Vernon Reed from Living Color, Screamin' Headless Torsos, Screaming, we're going to put the G on it. David Fusinski, Alex Skolnick, Thomas Pridgen, Victor Wooten, Keith Carlock, Cindy Blackman, Santana, Gene Lake. The list keeps going on and on. He's Berklee alum. He's also taught there as well. He is a ferocious technician and also has crazy pocket. We sit down. We talk about a new bass that he's been playing. We wonder about P basses. Are they for old people? We talk about it. We talk about his ferocious slap technique. He might demonstrate a little bit of that as well. And we talk about finding your lane. And I tell a story of being petrified when he showed up to a gig of mine. It's a really great, great interview. Before we get there, let me tell you what's going on at SBL. Right now, live class is open and it is going strong. And I have been teaching two classes at live class. I have a guided practice session, also a gear deep dive, and Steve Jenkins is doing a groove workshop. We're trying to do a lot of the SBL live class tutors, mentors, teachers on the podcast. Steve Jenkins is just one of many incredible people we have in this program. So check it out. Head to liveclassnow.com for more info on how to get involved. Hey, on the platform, on the Academy, SBL, we've got today, Monday, the 29th of January, Gary Willis, The Art of Listening. Next week, Monday, February 5th, we have Ariane Kapp doing Syncopation Elevation, Tighten Up Your Funk. Community news, we've got the XYZ Challenge ongoing. Set your intention and outcome in our Super Focused Challenge. Head over to the campus at SBL to find out what that's all about. And right now, we are currently offering $50 off the annual membership here at SBL. So to start your free 14-day trial and claim your discount, head over to www.playerspath.com. Again, that's playerspath.com. Get your discount. Take the tour of the Academy. You will be happy you did. Let's get to this episode.
I'm just going to take a sip of water.
Do it. I got I am too.
I got the Zorlac Metallica skateboard art.
Oh, hell yeah. Very good. I just have a boring black water bottle, dude.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I just, for some reason, I got into stickers, man. Like, I got this, I bought like five of these stickers. It's the same one, different colors. It's like the Metallica had a skateboard in their 80s.
Oh, it's so sick.
Zorlac put it out. And yes. They're really expensive now. If you look on eBay,
sure,
they're like almost $1,000 or $2,000. And right. Then at some point, like in 2021,
yeah,
dude,
yeah.
I got way into Liquid Death, man.
Yeah.
And like one of the dudes, his name's Anthony. He's one of the street team guys or one of the distributors. Yeah. They sent me a couple cases. I got like a Liquid Death hat.
Oh, and, hell yeah.
Some shirts and stuff. And
my wife would lose her mind. My wife loves Liquid Death. And she's always like, you've got to get us a Liquid Death like sponsorship. And I'm like, I don't know if they're interested in me, you know. But man, do you drink the like sparkly waters too? Like the Liquid Death sparkly waters?
I do.
Or are you just like water?
I drink a lot of water. I do like the sparkling waters. I have a SodaStream for a while. Half the first shelf in my refrigerator was Topo Chico.
Yeah.
I got a bit obsessive with that. I got, it was just really gratifying to open the fridge and just see
and
all those
see
glass
all?
Bottles.
Oh, I know. It is. Yeah. We've got a fridge in the basement that we stock full of LaCroix. like go to Costco, stock it full of LaCroix. And it's amazing to like open it up and it makes me feel safe.
Yeah, it's like if anything happens, at least this part is dialed in. You know, at least I know I got enough sparkling water to keep
water for a month.
Yeah, for me it's really just like sparkling water and coffee. You know, like
yes.
In the last year I shouldn't even say that. In the last 6 months I've really upgraded my home coffee setup.
Nice.
So, yeah, I guess it's because I'm doing a lot of stuff here. So part of me loves the idea of taking off to go to a coffee place and get stuff made there and you just go home. But logistically, it's more difficult sometimes. So it's like, all right, you know what? I'm just going to get a kick-ass electric kettle, and I'm going to get a good grinder, and I'm going to get good beans. And I got one of these like vacuum sealed canisters that you put the beans in. So it's,
yeah, it's super fresh. That's amazing. If we can dive into the coffee thing for a moment, what coffee maker do you use?
Well, I'm still an AeroPress guy. Do you ever mess with AeroPress?
I have friends that do it. I bought a Technivorm, just like a nice drip machine, and it makes a great, it's all, you know, kind of pour overy coffee, but I'm always making it for my wife too, and she drinks a bunch of coffee. So I feel like AeroPress is like a one cup situation, right?
Yeah. I actually have two AeroPress now because the first one, two AeroPresses. Not AeroPress-I, AeroPresses.
AeroPresses, yes. Yeah.
Like, what's the plural for Lexus? Is it Lexi or Lexuses?
Lexuses? I got a couple of Lexuses in the garage.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Lexi, that's too meta. That's like, oh, you went to college.
It's a little presumptuous. You sound like a tool if you say Lexi.
Yeah. I think whoever I first maybe heard that from somewhere, that might have been their intent. I just think it sounds funny because
That's great.
So I could technically make two cups at once by using both AeroPresses.
Yeah, sure.
My girlfriend just got me a pour over setup, so I'm trying to learn that. And it's like I don't know, man. I don't want to make an analogy that's false, but it's like trying to learn It's like maybe it's like trying to play like an instrument you haven't played before. You know, it's like AeroPress, I can make it in the dark with one hand behind my back, as you know, and I won't burn myself because the electric kettle I have has a nice light that illuminates what temperature it is. So I'll see enough light to not spill it. But like this pour over thing, I'm still like, I'm on my phone. I'm like, best way to make pour over. And so it's like,
yeah. It's like a whole new game.
Yeah.
Man, so the best cup of coffee I ever had was at a coffee shop called WTF, and it was in Brooklyn. And a guy made me a pour over in a V60 that was serious. Like, I think about that cup of coffee. It was so flavorful and good and incredible. I like never wanted it to end. I was like, oh my God. But again, like doing a pour over, it's just not enough coffee for my family. So we're like, I'm like a make it the night before, stumble in, hit the button in the morning, get, you know, a big old 10 cup carafe. That's because we're addicts. But man, the pour over life is very appealing.
I haven't mastered it. And I don't think I've gotten to pretty good yet. I think it's more like I've successfully completed the process. Let's try again.
Well, look, you need something in your life that you're working on because you're a base monster. So if you're working on the pour over thing, that's just fine. You got to have something to keep you humble, Steve Jenkins.
Oh man, I mean, I guess that's the one thing about the coffee realm is there's always something to keep yourself in the student mentality. Yeah. I mean, that's generally, I feel like it makes things a little bit easier too, you know, because then it's like you can at least not be afraid to try something.
Yes.
Which I think sometimes we can forget that doing what we do, you know, you can become a prisoner of maybe what the expectation is. And I think that's a real challenge.
What do you mean? Like, dig into that a minute. What do you mean by a prisoner of expectation? I like that, but I just don't know what you mean.
Well, you know how, like, I guess musicians kind of have, when people talk about their thing, you know, like, hey, my thing is da da da. Like, you know, when someone says so-and-so does their thing, and then you hear them play and it's like, oh yeah, that's their thing. You know, maybe the expectation for that to be what someone hears all the time. And it's almost like sometimes if you're in a situation where you have to play and you're there and I guess you know why you're there, but like, is that the kind of thing like that influences your creative decisions.
Yeah. And the gigs you get and the calls, you know, the DMs that you get and right, the offers that you get, like a prisoner of expectation, meaning like you've sort of planted a flag in the ground that's your thing. And now you've sort of made the bed and you have to sleep in it. Right.
Yeah,
man. Yeah. It reminds me, this thing happened to Scott recently where, and he talked about this on the pod, where he was doing a gig and he had a P bass and he had flats on it and he was playing a gig at a pub in Leeds and playing like really supportive, like bass playing. And someone traveled to see him play and came up to him afterwards. Like someone had driven a long way to see him play and said, "Oh, it was really cool. And you sounded good. It was just so much different than what I was expecting." And the guy said, "And honestly, I was a little disappointed." And Scott was like, "Oh my God. Oh, really?" Wow. And he was like, "Yeah, I just like, I've been listening to your album," you know, 'cause he just made that like heavy fusion album with Simon King and, you know, all those monsters. And, Scott was like, "Oh," and he was like, "I thought I was going to come and hear that." He was like, "And it was cool. I just wasn't expecting it. And I was just sort of like bummed by it." And I was like, "Holy shit. That is wild to have, you know, like if Scott sort of put a flag in the ground in terms of an artistry with that record and was like, this is what I love and this is who I am. And then someone came to see that and it wasn't, you know, and he wasn't doing that. And I was kind of like, oh man, you know, give me a break. If you're playing a gig that isn't your music, people should have a wide." He's like, "Yeah, but imagine if you went to see some, you know, a bass player that you really liked their style. Imagine if you went to see Pino and he was playing, you know, rounds on a, I don't know, rounds on a jazz bass with a pick. And you were there to like see him do his P bass thing or whatever." And you might go like, "Oh, weird." I mean, it might be cool, but it might also be kind of a cognitive dissonance. Yeah. You know, have you ever experienced something like that where like people know you for a thing? I mean, before we started this, you were talking about the record you put out in 04 and kind of like, and how your lane might be changing. Like, have you ever experienced that externally of someone coming to see you play, expecting one Steve Jenkins and getting another?
I mean, I think it's one of those, it's possible. I guess the one thing I'll say about some of the stuff that I've done, a lot of those musical situations were very pocket centric, even if there was room for other things. So I guess the idea of, do these rhythm section musicians or does this bass player, can they fulfill the function of bass while all this other stuff might be happening? And And I would say even my concept as a player, which I guess, you know, I guess one thing that was really interesting when I went to Berklee College of Music, there was a course called Survey of Bass Styles. And it's essentially what it sounds like. It's kind of like you sit in a class and you listen to all these different things. But here's what I'm talking about. The end of the class, like the final exam was, we had to talk about what our concept was, or kind of let people hear players that informed the concept. If, 'cause you know, I guess maybe it's an abstract thing to have to talk about it. You know, it's kind of like maybe in a meta way, trying to explain to somebody, "Hey, what makes you who you are?" And then maybe you're not sure how to answer that. Maybe you got to think about like your set of values or your sense of humor, or maybe like some people are very optimistic. Maybe some people are more on the cynical side. You know, you just don't know, but like there isn't really a button you can push that has the exact answer in perfect words. But what's easy to understand is like, okay, here are three things that I've listened to that really, really informed my curiosity about bass and music.
Yeah.
So I knew that like the stuff that I cited as influences, there was a lot of pocket stuff and there was like a lot of not extra stuff, but things that went beyond maybe what the responsibility of a bass player might be in like every situation. You know, like I remember one of the things I played, shout out to Doug Wimbish, was Tackhead's Strange Things, because, you know, I love the way Doug, I just love the way Doug plays. Like,
yeah,
he's such a monster.
Yes.
But, you know, at that time, I was also really, really heavily into, like, fusion stuff. So I was listening to a lot of people like Gary Willis, who also is an excellent pocket player. You know, I mean, there's grooves on those records.
Yes.
It's not like that is lacking.
Yeah, it's
like,
not floaty, you know?
No.
It's like very anchored, Gary's playing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like Face First is a funky ass fusion song. Like,
yes.
So, you know, there's a Gary Willis. I may have talked about Fema Ephron, who ironically I ended up playing in Screaming Headless Torsos after him when I was in that band. Cool. Fema is, like, to me, one of the greatest bass players. And he's one of those bass players that you learn to appreciate when you have to recreate their parts. Because he's just got such a great sense of writing a line, and his writing is really cool. But, you know, so it was kind of this weird mix of, like, I guess at that point when I was in music school, that's what my attention was on. But then there's also all the other stuff that, like, informs what got me to that place, which for me was, like, a lot of rock and metal and funk stuff and progressive rock stuff. Like, when I was in high school, it was like Headbangers Ball and, you know, MTV Raps and
yes.
You know, Rush.
Same.
And, you know, Rush was a huge deal to me, man.
Yeah, same.
Still is a huge deal to me. You know, like, I just saw Geddy Lee on that book tour. He played
in
LA.
How was that? How was it seeing him on that?
It was awesome, man. I mean, it was definitely, it was weird because, you know, in light of what's happened since Neil Peart died, and it was kind of the first time he's kind of gone out and talked.
Right.
I know, like, he and Alex have done an interview with, Strombo. I'm not going to try to say his last name, but that Canadian guy, George.
Yeah. Yep.
Strombolopoulos. Sorry, George. If you're
go Strombo.
Strombo.
It's all good. Yeah.
Yeah. And they, you know, they talk about some things, but, you know, that was one of those weird, I mean, I don't know, man, like, I don't want to, like, make this a sad thing, but that whole sense of loss, man, like, when you lose an icon that meant so
when
much
Neil
to people.
Passed.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't let it in. That, you know, there were a lot of great artists that passed, that have passed and continue to do so, right, every year.
Right.
But Neil, when he passed, it caught me off guard. And it was at, when did he pass? Do you remember? What year was it? Was it
2020? It was the beginning of 2020.
Dude. And it was just like, dong, like rang a bell of despair.
Right.
You know, like, dude, I would forget that he had passed, and then it would hit me, like, I would remember, and I would get sort of taken over by this, like, wave of grief. And that hadn't actually happened to me with anyone I didn't personally know, you know?
Right.
I've experienced loss in my family and friends, but I'd never experienced, you know, like, you know, when David Bowie passed, that was very sad. But I wasn't connected so much to his music that it crushed me with grief. Like, I still, dude, when I think about Neil passing, it's still heavy for me.
Yeah.
Because maybe like you, Rush was, you know, Rush was my ticket out of, like, only liking, like, the Beastie Boys and Poison, you know, like, before Rush, it was, like, hair metal and hip hop, and that was it. And then, you know, my uncles were like, no, check this out. And Tom Sawyer, you know, blew my freaking face off.
Yeah.
So for me, yeah, Neil too, it was a really heavy loss. So heavy. Yeah.
Yeah. I got two things to say about that because, and one of them kind of relates, like, to the whole idea of having, like, this musical lineage of things that kind of push you to the next place to explore. You know, like, for me, you know, like, Kiss is what got me into music when I was, like, a little kid. Mm-hmm. I was, like, 3. 'Cause, and to me, I guess, I always think of musicians that make you want to, like, you know, those guys literally were superheroes in the 70s.
Yeah,
you know,
for
like,
sure.
That's what
totally.
But right? To me, the death of Neil Peart and was kind of like watching the death of Superman. Like, I don't know if you ever read that comic book where Superman dies and you see, like all these like heroes, and they're just like, you know, they're all sad, you know, and it's like they're, I mean, you know, that guy really took them out. I think it was Doomsday took them out. Like, but man, it was like, I was reading drummers who I would have never thought listened to Rush talk about. And that was what was heavy about it. It's like, Rush was kind of like, I mean, I think the minute people I know wanted to kind of move into jazz, like the idea of playing things that are like through composed in the same way every night, for some reason this becomes not cool, you know? But I think that's just a young music school student thing. I think when you start to realize, oh, if you make your own vocabulary and that's what's going to take you through life, there's really nothing cooler than that.
Right.
You know? So yeah. But anyway, we got here because I think that's kind of where I ended up occupying when I got finished with my studies at school. A lot of the music I was playing somehow fell in between music that was pocket oriented and stuff where there was stretching and the ability to maybe play more than just bass parts. Were concerned, you know? So it's been a kind of an uncomfortable existence sometimes because
do you feel like you're sort of a, like in between those two spaces?
Yeah.
A little bit. you're not fully planting in pocket world and you're not fully planting in like fusion solo whimsical world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. I think I love that though. So it's kind of one of those, like, if it's not broke, then don't fix it kinds of things. Cause I think a lot of people that we all look up to, there's probably a lot of that going on, even if it's not widely known, you know?
Yes.
Cause I just think we all have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of depth to what people tend to listen to, just even judging by what the average musician I know talks about.
Yes.
So there's always going to be like different references, but it's like, man, you know, like I have a P bass with flats. I'll bust it out sometimes. People have seen it on Instagram and it's not like the other stuff that I do, but it's just one of those things. I don't know, man. So it's like, I think the idea of, I'm of two different minds on this because, and I think I'm not trying to make this controversial because I don't know that it is really that crazy to say, but I don't think there's anything wrong with being a highly informed, versatile specialist.
Of course, absolutely.
Versus trying to be all things to all. Yeah. Versus trying to be all things to all people. Yeah. Which I think is kind of not to me, just to me, because I don't want, you know, other people might have a different outlook. I don't know if that's the smartest thing from a business standpoint.
To be a chameleon or to be like a flag, a flag planter.
I think to be a chameleon. Yeah. I think if the chameleon is like, okay, the chameleon has four colors, but they're all pretty good, then that's a good chameleon. But if it's like, when the chameleon turns yellow, I'm not buying it.
Dude, you know what I mean? Right. Man, so I always thought, like, I came up as a band guy in this, you know, in this like rock band. And then when that kind of fell away, I was like, I'm going to be a chameleon. I need to go out and taste a bunch of different things. I need to try to wear all the different colors. And I had this real bent of like, I'm going to fool you so that you don't know that I can also slap, that I can also tap. Like, if I'm going to play your blues gig, you are going to think that I'm a blues bass player.
Sure.
And I don't know that I succeeded in fooling people of that, but that was my intent. And I will say that I agree with you to a point. I think for me anyway, being a chameleon was an incredible passageway to understanding what I liked outside of my boyhood, my like childhood rock band that I was literally, I mean, pretty much in from 13 to 30. So I – found that like I had to go out and like date a bunch of different musical styles. Like I had to like taste a bunch of different food to go, oh, okay, to understand what it was before I kind of had an informed opinion of like who I was, sort of, you know? I don't know, man. Like, so the chameleon thing for me was really necessary.
Yeah.
But I think for me, then it became a thing of I gravitated towards certain things and then would sort of start to get called for certain things. Nobody's really calling me to play P bass with flats. I love doing it. Yeah. And I think I'm good at it, but that's not typically what people are like, oh man, that's your thing. You know, like nobody says that to me. But do people say to you, oh, that's your thing? Like, you know, Danny Moe has that great story of, you know, when he was playing, you know, left hand muting all over a bass, you know, with just one finger and, you know, putting his other fingers in front. And someone said, man, that's it. And he was like, what? And they're like, that's your sound. And he was like, oh. And it was this like, dong. It was like a bell going off for him. Did that, has that ever happened to you? Has someone ever said to you, oh man, that's your thing. Oh, that's Steve Jenkins' thing.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Like that's, I also wanted to like clarify too, to your point about the chameleon, and I'll come back to this answer. I think that journey is necessary also.
Yeah.
I just mean when you're done taking that journey and you've compiled all the, your findings, you know, ultimately you're going to kind of, what's going to stick with you are the things that made the biggest impression. You know, I think it's important to have the ability to get a few different sounds if you want to work with different people. But I'm saying like ultimately it's going to distill into something that's more personal because I think that's just what happens. But I think the other thing that happens is like it's possible that like you might have all this stuff that you can do and it may never come up because of whatever. But yeah, I don't, you know, I guess the thing is like, I don't really know. People have told me I have a thing. I've heard this from people and I don't really know what it is. And and sometimes I don't really know if it's any of my business to know. Cause I think it's one of those things where it's like, there's always a point of dissecting things a little bit too much. But I feel like one thing I constantly try to do is like update my operating system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like,
what do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, I don't know, man. Like I went through a phase. There was a point when I moved to New York and, we're going back about almost 20 years. But I moved to New York in the fall of 2004. And that same time period, I put out my first record. Now, if you listen to that album now, and I'm still proud of it for what it was, but what you're going to hear is someone who's kind of like heavily influenced by a bunch of different people. I don't necessarily think it's a bass record, but you can definitely tell that like, okay, this guy definitely likes Matt Garrison, definitely likes Jocko, Marcus, some other people. Like there's all little indicators that these are things that like are in the lexicon. And I played a 5-string bass with a high C. But because I was working with, you know, at that time when I moved to the city, I was playing a lot with a guitar player named David Fuzinski. And I was in this trio with him called Keef. We made a record called Keef Express. And, you know, the thing that I learned from someone like Fuzinski, he's one of the most unique guitar players on the planet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's on Michel Andiaciello's first record. If you watch those early clips, you know, like that's his solo on Soul record. He's an amazing musician. Maybe the one lesson I learned from him, which made me rethink my playing, hence updating my operating system, I just moved to the same city that Matt Garrison moved in or that lives in. Right. You know, like I moved there, he lives there.
Yep.
I'm not taking any work from Matt, man. Like I can't play like Matt. You know, I liked the idea of exploring the C string. Obviously, a tuning is more than the person that utilizes it. Totally, you know?
Sure.
But if we're talking about how was I best going to serve that music, I'm not going to play iller chords than Fuse, even if I could play them. Like, it's just not going to be a thing. Sure. But I know if I play, like, lower pitches, if I put the B string back on my 5, that might do something. If I use sub bass sounds, that'll do something.
It got me thinking. Giving the space for him to do the things on the top. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Or maybe just thinking about the idea of letting go of the things that maybe like the people I admire are doing and just trying to figure out for myself, like, well, what do I like? Because I think that's another part of the development of playing that gets tested, you know, because I think it's like, if you're going to swim, I guess my feeling is if I'm going to swim in creative waters, like, it's not that I can force how I sound, but I can definitely make decisions about what I don't want to sound like. So I don't immediately get compared to someone I'm never going to be able to play like. You know,
Right.
Regardless of their abilities, it's just, yeah, it's like,
yeah, you don't want to get compared to Jocko or Hadrian or, you know what I mean? Like the, like these absolute beasts, because yeah, then it's like, but those guys like are these untouchable guys, right?
Right. Or they just have a really strong thing. And I think by and large, if the pursuit is to be good at music, and try to figure out a way to do something unique with it, that's a better pursuit to me than like, hey, I want to learn how to sound like this person so the world will revere my abilities.
But that's a young person's game, right?
It is.
Like again, that thing I think is really necessary when you're starting out, because it's sort of like these blueprint lanes, or like, you know, you learn Jocko stuff, or you learn Mike Dirnt, or, you know, whatever it is that you're into, because you need to like gather the vocabulary.
Yeah.
But then what do you feel like is the turning point of going from being like a gatherer of personalities and vocabulary to like, oh, I'm going to put this into the meat grinder and out. There's going to come a product out that is like your thing. Like what's a tipping point?
I think the tipping point for me with that whole concept was, not wanting to feel the anxiety of having to live up to the people I was influenced by.
Yes.
I know I have friends who are related or the sons of like famous musicians.
Yes.
And I can't imagine the burden that must be on some level, you know?
Yes.
And like, I think having the freedom to not be anything and just trying to listen to the, you know, the things that spark one's interest, that's kind of what the turning point was for me. But also kind of just observing the people I was playing with, you know, like Fuse is one guy, Vernon Reed's another guy. Like I play a lot of music with him. And like just watching a guitar player, like watching people play an instrument that like, it's really hard to have an identity on, is a really inspiring thing. And it's like both of these guys, by the way, have played on lots of records. Like it's not, they're not just jettisoned to like, you know, weirdo music land. Like, it's like, you know, you know, it's like those guys have done a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to spill this tea, but it's like 20 plus years old. Vernon actually did some playing with D'Angelo on those Voodoo Sessions.
No way.
I don't know what the track was, but like there are a bunch of musicians that like were there from what I heard.
Whoa. Yeah. Wow. Crazy.
And I don't know what the song was. I don't know what the purpose of it was. Like, so like, there's no way to fact check this, but Vernon's not one to make up stories. And, but I'm saying like, I think there's this kind of mentality. I don't know if it comes from music school musicians or if it just comes from maybe the way the musician economy works. But like, I think sometimes like the ability to play sessions sometimes seems to be the things that legitimize how someone views somebody else.
Right.
I don't believe in that personally, because my thing is like, dude, I only need to hear Cliff Burton on Metallica's records. I don't need any other proof that that guy was a fucking badass, right?
Of course. But, yeah. Like, you don't need to hear Neil do the Buddy Rich thing.
No.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, his voice in Rush was enough.
Right.
Yes. Right.
I don't think it necessarily, like, you know, one thing I've talked about with friends of mine, like drummers, cause you know, I love drums. You know, and I love all of the drummers that Sting has had in his bands, you know?
Yeah.
But like, as great as those guys play the Police songs, I still like the way Stuart Copeland plays it a little bit better.
I know what you mean. Just the identity of his just like, fuck it style. Yeah. Just like risk taking, man. Such an identity in the sound of his playing. All three of those guys, actually. But I mean, for sure him especially. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same. But, I know what you mean. Yeah. To hear Josh Freese play it is so different than hearing Stuart Copeland play it, even though Josh is an absolute monster.
Yeah.
It's just
I like how he does something. It.
Yeah.
Josh? And Keith Carlock. When Keith was in Sting's band, Keith murders it. They all do, man. Like I saw Manu Katchay, you know, I saw Manu Katchay like fucking burn through Synchronicity 2. And it was like the only time on that particular show that the audience particularly perked up. There's some, maybe it was the tempo. No disrespect to Sting. He's got a wide range of music.
Yeah, but sure.
There's something I wanted to speak to with this question you asked because
please.
Unbeknownst to maybe you and Scott, because I know I'm in the SBL cinematic universe.
Yes, you are.
I walk or hike like 5 miles a day, you know, and it's been a thing I've been doing for the last couple of years, got into shape and that whole thing. Right. But there was one thing, I can't remember who it was. It might've been recently. It may have been, but it was Scott or you both were talking about the idea of having to like abandon belief systems to evolve. And that's maybe the best way I can explain what the turning point was. It was trying to kind of think about, okay, what is this at? Why do I actually feel this way about what I'm doing? And why does it feel so restricting?
Yeah.
And maybe the idea is to like lift the restrictions because it's one of those things where this is only something I care about. But the world doesn't care about this, you know?
Right.
Like if you ask somebody who's the best drummer in the world or who's the best bass player in the world, how many people are going to say Dave Grohl? And how many people are going to say like, who's an amazing drummer, man? Like Marco Miniman. Like,
right.
Both could be true, right?
Of course.
But I think it's all perception, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, I'm sure Dave Grohl is not like, well, man, I don't know if I can play the stuff Marco Miniman played. Like, but musicians are like that because it's like, well, shit, you know, like I think I can do this, but I don't know if I have the thing that person has. And I think
it's a very it's like music is sport. It's a young person's thing again. It's that thing of like, remember when we were little kids, we go, oh, how long has Victor Wooten been playing?
Right.
Oh, he's been playing for 25 years. Cool. I've only been playing for 2. So I'm going to be better by the time I'm there. I mean, remember those metrics we used to, like the silly things you'd think as a teenager? And I remember asking people, how long have you been playing? And they'd go, 7 years. And I'd be like, ha, okay, I got you. Because we thought that it was a sport in the beginning. No one ever told us, or me, I should speak to me, that it wasn't a sport. That it wasn't a thing. Well, no, there's actually no podium, you know? And like, I mean, there's certain awards that are given that I guess sort of maybe spotlight, you know, but it really isn't like that, right? It's so subjective and there's no trophy for first, second, and third. But we didn't know that kind of growing up, you know?
Yeah. Or
you learn that later.
Yeah. I think that's a big turning point though, is like you have to let go of the stuff that maybe fueled the first part of your journey, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I always tend to talk in metaphors and analogies, but I always think about it as like, you know, there's like that part of the rocket ship that falls off into the sea.
Yes.
Hopefully like the raw ambition and the narcissism and the spite. Because let's be honest, man, spite is a great motivator too. It's like, I'll show you that, you know.
Yep, I can do this. You said I couldn't. You don't think I'm shit. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like it's hopefully that's part of the rocket that falls away is what you're saying.
Yeah. Mostly. I mean, I do think, I do think it's kind of like burning like dirty fuel. Like it can get you some places, but it you probably don't want to use it for too long, you know, cause it's toxic.
Right.
And it's yeah. toxic for you and it's toxic for the people around you. But yeah, I think that's it for me. It came down to, I think wanting to adapt and constantly change just came from like one, freeing myself up from some of the belief systems I had about playing, which is like totally, you know, like it's young stuff, you know, once you start yeah. to meet people and it's like, oh, wait a minute, you know, it's, you kind of have this perception or narrative, what you think something is. And then when you get close to it, it's like, oh, really? You know, like, have you ever sure. had that moment where you like, you kind of get, you know, maybe, I know everyone says this all the time, but like you get close to like the sausage being made and you're like, oh, that's what it is. Really? Like that's what, that's
right. And, what that and thing it's is. Maybe not as magical or maybe not as, yeah, as incredible. I tell a story occasionally of being on the forums when I was really young and I was on Talkbase and there were these people that would post a lot and had mm-hmm. big opinions and had, you know, and I revered them. I had no idea who they were. They just seemed like the big dogs at the dog park. And so I would be like, oh, these guys are right. And, you know, they're opinionated. And one day one of the guys posted a clip of his band. And I was like, I am about to experience Nirvana. Like I'm going to be blown away by this guy's band. And
the band Nirvana or the Sensation? Sorry.
The Sensation. Okay. Sorry. Yes. And, you know, probably though, similarly to the first time I heard Smells Like Teen Spirit, blown away by the Sensation and the band. But right. I was like ready to be, you know, like jaw dropped and it was absolutely terrible. And I thought, and the whole, I just reeled. I was like, oh my God, I've been putting so much stock into this guy's opinions and into this guy's gear choices. And I could not have been more like, oh, I do not like seeing how the sausage is made, you know, like I don't want it. Oh man. And it really actually gave me some good space between like, oh, I need to trust me. I need to trust my ears, you know, cause I was like, oh, well maybe all the things I'm doing are bad, you know, because it says that they are on the forum. And, you know, I had to really learn how to trust myself, you know, and my ears and my likes and dislikes. It took me a long time though. To come to a point where I felt like I could trust myself.
That to me is like the hardest thing. That's the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
Because the temptation to do the thing that you think is going to satisfy or impress people.
Yes.
That's really the trap door.
Yes. You're absolutely right. You stand on the X and someone just drops you through it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah, man. To people please or to do the thing that you think is going to get you that gig, like to act a certain way, to play a certain way because you think that that's what everybody wants from you. Yeah, man. I've definitely been guilty of that. And I think we all have at some point.
Oh yeah.
But to come to a place where you're like, oh no, I don't need to do that. I can do this other thing and it's going to be fine. I have to just tell a quick version of this story when I met you in person for the first time, because I think it speaks to a little bit about this thing that we're talking about where, you know, identity and all that. I was right pre-pandemic. I was playing in LA with Eric Hutchinson on a trio tour where I was playing a bunch of like solos, like guitar solos, but written solos on the bass. I was kind of going in between being a bass player and then being sort of the lead instrument because Eric plays keys and guitar, but he's singer-songwriter. He's accompanying himself. He's not ever stepping out in solo world. So our guitar player quit. Eric's like, can you just do all of it on the bass? I said, I don't know. And it was the first tour doing it. And I was really excited and having a good time, but it was also pretty daunting. And I remember you were like, hey man, I want to come see you at the Troubadour. And I was like, awesome. That'd be amazing. And then I, in my mind, I was like, I hope he doesn't come. And that is so shitty. Like, and it tells you just more about me than it does about anything else. Like, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be in my head the whole night. And we came down the stairs to start the gig and I see Steve Jenkins, you know, there you are. And I was like, God damn it. I was like, it's amazing. I'm so glad he came, but also, oh, cause now I'm going to be in my head. And you know, and the gig went fine or whatever, but I saw you afterwards and I remember telling you that. I remember saying to you, like, thank you for coming, but also fuck you for coming, you know? And you were like, what? You were like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, dude, you know that thing where, you know, there's someone in the crowd that you admire their playing, and then you're just in your head about, you know, oh, I wonder if, you know, and you said, oh, like it was so, like, I'll never forget it. You were like, dude, no, it's not like that. It's lanes, it's superheroes. And I was like, what do you mean? Yep. You're like, well, you know, like you're Wolverine and I'm Thor and you're not upset that I have the hammer and I'm not upset that you have the claws. And I was like, oh dude, well, first of all, are you calling me a superhero of the base? And you were like, yeah, man. And I was like, oh, that's so sweet. And like, but the superhero analogy is really cool. And I remember we talked about this, like the superhero thing, they all have their tragic backstory and things that they wrestle with. But typically in the superhero world, they're not pining away for someone else's ability.
No.
You know, they're not like, oh, dang, I'm so sad that I have these claws and I wish I had this other weapon or this other way of dealing with the world. They're struggling and dealing with and empowered by their own set of unique features.
Right.
And I think that is such an interesting way to look at it. And I never thought about that analogy before, but I think about that now all the time, actually. Like, I think about the superhero analogy and that you said that to me at the Troubadour right before we went into lockdown, and it was a huge gift. So,
oh wow!
Thanks for coming to that gig, dude. It was a big deal to me.
And you nailed those solos, man. It was great, and I was inspired by it. I mean, I guess so. The thing is like, I suffer from the same things that probably most people struggle with,
yes.
Like, you know, imposter syndrome. You know, like I mean, more than people might even realize.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's one of those things, like you just have to kind of figure out how to bypass it as much as you can.
Yes.
And for me, I guess there's a couple answers. One is to try to look at it like that, because the one thing about superheroes, like I'm a huge nerd, so like I read comic books, or you know, at one point read them a lot more than I do now, but I'm still a fan of that type of thing. And I like, you know, maybe there's a few too many movies right now, but like, I do think overall, like in terms of the way a lot of these characters were written in the comics themselves, they all have got their cross to bear, you know,
yes,
like for all the stuff that Wolverine can do, he's immortal. And that means he's going to lose people forever. Because you know what I mean? There's always going to be like
a downside.
there's always a downside, you know? Yeah, like, I mean, when you think about people who are touted as like, I mean, I think anyone who does their thing well repeatedly, to me, that's, I don't think that's not amazing. You know, like I think it's great.
Yeah.
And I have reverence for that. But I think about the people who are constantly being called amazing and what kind of pressure that must be. You know, to be that person, you know, like imagine like what it's like to be like, I don't know, like we can go through the list, like Jordan or Tiger Woods or like these like prodigious musicians that can't fail. Like they have to live up to this standard. Right.
Well, thinking about Victor Wooten, right? And like I've heard him say that he just wishes he could play bass. But typically he's being called to do a solo or do some sort of like incredible slap thing, you know, and he's made this bed and he acknowledges that, but sometimes he wishes too, right? That like, like just playing whole notes. Cause he's really, really freaking good at that too.
You know,
like his basic skills, you know, like are second to none, but you're right. There's so much pressure to be Victor, right?
Yeah. I guess maybe it's more that there's the possibility of there being pressure. Like it's a real thing. I think I don't want to like assume what he would say, but I would like to think he'd have some great astute observation that would blow us all away and say, well, you know, like we're all just a shared consciousness and there really are no individuals. We're just all one. And this is all, you know, like whatever that kind of thing,
And
I'm not making fun of that mentality at all, but I think he would probably default to the humanity of it all. But I think the other thing is if I want to see a homie play music, I don't want to see that person play badly. Like, you know,
of course.
It's just more like in the spirit of wanting to watch something and be taken someplace. You know, it's
dude,
like,
dude, and actually that whole thing, I talked to Wimbish about this at one point too. And he was like, oh man, if there's somebody in the crowd, I always bring them on stage. And I'm like, dude, that's incredible. I always want him to come sit in. And I was like, wow, that's so cool. But this thing of like, oh, now I'm scared. And now I'm in my own head. That's right. Actually like very selfish. It's juvenile and selfish way to think because maybe you weren't watching every freaking note I played. Like you were there, you were enjoying the whole experience. You were, drinking a drink. You like to presume that someone is there and just taking notes and writing down all the things that they hate about your playing. That is a fucking really selfish way to think.
Yeah. Well, that's what YouTube's for, man. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, right. You missed that bar, that transition, Allison. I've heard this song a million times. And
oh, yeah. Well, there's plenty of that. I remember when I started to do SBL, Scott was like, oh, just so you know, you're about to step into some shark-infested waters. You know, we're talking to people about how to play these things. There's definitely going to be people critical.
I've been bit by those sharks in the SBL waters. And for a while, I'm not going to say what the video is, but it's still up there. And I think it's got like 500,000 views, but I did an instructional video for them. Like I've never talked about this, but and I didn't realize I was going to talk about it today, but
yeah,
today is where we set the record straight.
Let's go, dude. Let's go.
So I did a video. I did a course for SBL in 2017.
Yes.
I'm going to admit it wasn't the most structured thing, but we talked about some concepts that I think are useful.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about this muted thumb groove technique that I use.
Yes.
I did not invent, but there's things that through practicing and learning things, I've discovered things that work for me. So when Scott does this thing where he's kind of about to introduce a clip. Remember when he was doing like videos like that, where he'd like start talking,
yeah,
like, we're going to watch this.
Yeah.
So, he goes into this thing and he's like, let's go watch Steve do his thing.
Oh, sure.
And the Keyboard Warriors came. I was like, well, actually, it was invented by Victor Wooten. It's like, what he meant by that. He meant to say, like, course, his presentation, you know?
Yeah.
And it's almost like people were kind of, like, coming for me because I didn't recite the lineage of every bass player that I learned some shit from.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Guess what, folks? Abraham Laboriel was doing some of that same stuff. There's a bunch of people, all due respect to the innovators, there's a lot of people that wrote that book.
Of course.
And so it's kind of like, you know, if someone's going to teach like a picking exercise or like how to play with like two fingers or raking, like these are all things that are in the lexicon. I expect everyone to know where it came from, but in no way was I trying to take credit for anyone else's stuff. And neither was Scott. He wasn't like, Steve invented. It was just like this weird thing.
Of course.
Where I use like some thumb techniques from slapping. Like, you know, like essentially it's like.
Oh yeah. Like, let's go.
So you have like some stuff where it's like, and let me take the reverb off. It's like.
Yes. Yes.
So it's like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. That's cool. It's like muted thumb thing from the slap tradition.
Because you can get like groups of four. You know, and just.
Crazy. Yes, yes. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. You know, and that's like where the hand flows.
Right, and then it can become a pocket thing.
And I'm getting tripped up on it.
That's sweet. Yeah, and you know, oh, that's hip. Yeah, and I mean, Scott's going to say, like, this is, oh, yeah, check out Steve doing his thing, and be like, that's not. Yeah, man.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, it's just coming from, like.
Right, from slap world.
Yeah, and that's all I was talking about, you know?
It wasn't. Of course, yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
So.
Oh, dude. Yeah,
but I mean, but anyway,
I had to develop a really thick skin on YouTube. people that honestly sometimes comment for attention, you know,
right?
And like they want to seem like, you know, but I've really had to separate it into people that are hateful and mean. They're people that are just like attack you for the way you look or the way you talk or your energy or whatever, and those people can go straight to hell. It's all good. Like yeah. I have empathy for that. Actually, I'm like, oh, you must be really hurting to like take time to call somebody a name. Like that's really silly, whatever. But then there are the ones that hurt. The comments that hurt are the ones that are critical, that like I think they maybe want your content to be better, and you kind of feel like what they said is true. That's the worst one.
Right.
You know, like if someone is like, oh man, no, actually it's this, and you kind of like, you're called out. I'm trying to actually get better at like not thinking of those people as haters, but thinking right. of those people as like people that actually want the content to just be better. Like they want me to do a better job. Yeah. And I don't actually think there's anything wrong with that, but that's taken me some time to like let that stuff in and be like, oh, okay, maybe I could do a better job of explaining this or playing this or something. But yeah, man. It's crazy.
I think it's an interesting thing, man. I didn't know what to do with that, because it's like, do I respond to all these people? But then I think that's like a rookie move. Like just, you gotta let it be what it is. But, but dude, you know, it's like what I've realized is like, there is this really great chasm between some of those techniques have evolved, you know, but like, you know, I didn't feel the need to defend myself, but I got receipts. I've been doing a lot of that stuff for years, for 20 plus years. You know, it didn't, I didn't just listen to Tosin Abasi and get into, you know, like some of the, like the.
Yes.
Like groups of five.
Dude, if Tosin called you, would you do that gig?
I mean, it's what's funny is I'm really good friends with Javier, and I know Tosin a little bit. I don't know, man. I kind of like that they don't have a bass player, but I would love to
I know
play,
what you mean.
I would love to play with them. You know, like I mean, there's a lot of stuff that would be interesting, but I kind of feel like they got it covered. I mean, I think the thing is like now that I am in kind of my feet are in the multi-scale waters a little bit. I guess, you know, I could do it. I would love to do it, but I don't know, man. It kind of works. Kind of works great the way they have it, you know. And
it does.
I think like, yeah.
Ooh. But man, I mean, and you said it, I wonder, could we talk for just a moment about basses? Because you, I've seen a photo of you with that beautiful six string Dingwall, and you just said it, you dipping your toes into the multi-scale waters. Yeah. I mean, are you thinking about like diving in hard on a Dingwall and a six string?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I still, I still love, the basses I have, and I have another instrument that I'm going to be playing as well. Cause I still, you know, like that's the thing. Like I still like four and five string
sure.
and I've played other multi-scale instruments before.
Yes.
But the Dingwall thing is really unique because of the scale length, and it's got a vibe. And I think to the people who, cause it's real easy to kind of look in and you know how every instrument, and the accoutrement, there goes my French one.
I dig it. Yeah, I dig it.
Yeah, the shit that goes along with everything. Like, you know how, like, you can kind of, like, you look at the, like, look at the gear and guess what kind of music the person plays. Like,
of there's course.
Always,
yes.
There's always some kind of, like, you know, oh, you play a Mustang and you got flats on that. Like, I bet you play indie rock.
Right.
Or, like, you play a jazz bass with, like, DRs and, like, you play out of, like, you know, like, what's an amp that would be, like, real, like an SWR, you know, it's like, oh, you must be really into, like,
clean
this kind of thing. Or you play, like, a Rickenbacker out of, like, a beat-up SVT. You must be, like, I don't know, man. And so...
Yeah, sure.
So I know Dingwalls kind of occupy this really, really kind of, like, oh, it's that thing. But, man, it's so many things. Like,
I know. It really can be.
I mean, you've played one, or you might even have one.
I don't anymore. It was a loner and it got passed along to someone else, but I loved it. And I actually used them on sessions and I had this beautiful D-Rock five string. It was a custom, the Canadian five string D-Rock that was freaking so sick. And I would love to have another one, but yes, they're so versatile, as I know, you know. Yeah.
My thing with instruments, I've always really liked the Fender jazz bass paradigm. That's always been what I come from. Even when I got into other basses, like, I've had some great ones. It's always been like two pickups with a blend knob or some kind of way to put them together. I've been doing that for a long time. I still like it. When I got that Dingwall 6, it was kind of like, I felt something I haven't felt in a long time. And I haven't really put out any music where I've used it, you know, and there, I haven't done a lot of content in a while. Like, I just teased that photo, but I think, you know, like all great instruments, like this is like that for me also. Like, you just, when you play something and you're like, you don't want to put it down.
Right.
I think that means something, you know.
Agreed.
I have other instruments too that I think are more, I use this word not to disrespect them, but they're utilitarian. Like, they serve a need, but they can do great things. And when I'm playing them and it's the right thing, I love it. You know, like I have one of those cat basses that Carrie makes. I love it. It's such a cool bass. I have a P bass that's strung with flats and, you know, it's not, I wouldn't say it's like the sound I use all the time. It's not even like my sound, but that was an instrument where, I bought it. Cause I think here's something that like I noticed, like there's this weird mentality where it's like somehow P bass is like getting your AARP card or whatever. I haven't gotten my AARP card, but you know what I mean? It's like the ultimate sign of bass player maturity. You know, it's like, I got a P bass with flats and my action is high as fuck. And I just don't care anymore, you know? And it's like, it's like, you know,
it's great.
All these people that are part of the music business that doesn't exist anymore, they fucking played this shit. You know, like, that's maybe the other weird thing is I think people have glamorized and like fetishized an era that no longer exists. And if we're going to get really, if we're going to get meta about it, I get that, like, you know, I think what it really is it's the history of recorded music and that's what people are leaning on. But it's like, I've always pushed back against that, man. Like, or I've always chased the sound. Like, to me, that's not enough of a reason. Like, I think some people genuinely, that's their voice and you can tell it is, you know, but
of course
I think if someone's going to use something when it makes sense to, that to me is more authentic. But the other part of it is like, if you get asked to play something, cause that's the sound they want, then that's the easiest conversation to have in the world. Because all someone, all someone has to say is like, "Hey, I want it to be like this." But I guess when I bought that P bass, I was really unsure about it for like a month. Like, I bought this thing and I just kind of look at it, and I was like, I looked at it. Like, I think at one point I put a different pick guard on it because like maybe I'll like it better if it's got like a black pick guard. Because this you know, like this gold anodized thing is cool, but like. You know, like who the fuck am I, man? Like, I'm not like, they're not, no one's calling me Duck Jenkins. You know what I'm saying? So like,
yeah, right.
So,
right. Of course.
So, and
of
not
course.
That I wouldn't be honored as fuck if that happened, but you know what I'm saying? So,
right.
So
of
like,
course.
It was sitting there and I just decided, okay, I'm going to use this on the next three. I got this. This was like back in like 2013 or something.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to use this on the next three gigs I have. And that will be the judge and jury. Like, do I keep this thing or do I not keep it?
Yeah.
And they were gigs. What happened? Man, it was great. Like I loved it. And I loved it for reasons I wouldn't have really, expected to love it for, because have you had that experience? And I don't man, I don't know if I'm like outing myself where I'm exposing a mentality I may have had at one point about playing music, but it's like, you ever have that thing where like, I know I have this instrument where I can play all my stuff on it.
Yep. Sure.
With the P bass, couldn't do that, man. I mean, physically I could, but it didn't sound the same to me.
Yes, of course.
And I think what I liked about it was playing this instrument was kind of a void. Like there's something, it didn't scare me, but it's like, there's enough familiarity to it. And there's a certain thing that it does that sure, I could do these other things on it, but it's almost asking me, why do you want to?
Right. It's like Play Me Simply, and the sound is going to fill the room in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's that's what happens with P basses. I mean, the great story of, you know, Michael League playing Tim LaFave's P bass and going from a Smith to a P bass forever after that, you know, and like, because it does do something in an ensemble environment that is pretty special. But I, like you, man, I wrestle with the P bass being, I tried for a while. I toured with one for a while. I was out for a couple years on the road. I have an old 65. You know, I bought like a real old P bass and put labellas on it and like really did it. And I could just never, like, it sounded good, but I was never inspired by it. Like, I would hear it and be like, that's really nice in the mix. But for me, a P bass never inspired me to like pick it up and play a right, or like, it was just like the drill bit I needed maybe for a gig.
Right.
But it wasn't the thing that was going to like inspire me to make music.
Yeah.
And then I felt guilt about that because all the cool guys were playing P basses, you know? Yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
But there's a lot of cool guys that don't play P basses. So you got to remember
that. Of course.
But I think there's a way to embrace something and love it for what it is and not feel bad for what it might not be for you. And I think, cause I mean, you know, there's that urge that I don't know if this has been, inflated due to the way social media has changed and rewired everybody's brain, but like the need to diss something that's not yours. You know, like, well, I don't do that shit, man. Like, I don't want, you know, like, I don't want to play a fucking blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I don't know, man. Like, it kind of gets silly when you move that thing to other stuff. It's like, man, I don't like drinking water out of Dixie cups. I like solo cups because, and it's like, dude, okay. Like both will presumably hydrate whoever's going to use it.
Yeah. Right. Like, that's really funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We get so much of our identity maybe tied up in the brand or the vibe or the look or the, And so many, most people don't care. They're not even realizing that you're playing that game, you know, like they're not, it's not even a thing for people. Man, speaking of hydration, let's go. I've got to ask you, man, I have to ask you about this thing coming up with SBL called Live Class that you're going to be a part of that. I am so pumped that you're doing it. And oh my gosh, dude, the rhythm, you're doing the rhythm and groove workshop, right?
Yes.
Or is it called like rhythm and groove boot camp? What's it called?
I like workshop. Boot camp makes it sound like I got to wear a whistle. And dude, I don't have a whistle.
Come on, dude, do it. Oh my God. Now I want you to. Now I want you to be just the drill instructor.
Just wear a whistle sergeant? And like,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think what I'm going to essentially talk about are going to be things that have to do with like, different things to consider, different considerations maybe like with, you know, I'm not going to try to like spoil it out here, but like playing around with like ideas by moving them by one division, you know, stuff that. Like,
because how like a 16th note can change a groove.
Exactly. You know?
Yes.
Like, you know, that groove to the Big Payback, like the James Brown song.
Yes.
This would be a good place for them to edit that in. Imagine if you take that groove. See what I did there?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. A little post-production. Hey,
man, I watch SBL content. I'm a fan as much as I am an employee.
Same. Yeah. I am too. Yeah.
So just imagine taking that backing track and just moving it over, like, and, you know, like stuff like that. Like, just the idea of like how to take a simple idea and how to change that idea without making it more complicated, but maybe doing something more like that, where it's like, you're not playing more notes, you're moving where those notes are. So things like that, we may delve into some technical things that have to do with like ways to maybe, you know, make certain things feel better. 'Cause sometimes like I've noticed with certain students, I have some of the way in which they'll play a song, if they're string skipping, they might overshoot where they're trying to go. Like they're going from the E to the D string.
Right.
All those extra movements can affect your time feel because you're,
of course, yes.
You know, so it's like kind of like how to hone in on that stuff, how to play relaxed. You know, so it's going to probably be a mixed bag, but it's going to be framed from the concept of like how it serves timekeeping and stuff and playing grooves. And I think another thing I'd like to delve into with that, because when I was talking to Jim, everyone knows, I don't know if everyone knows Jim.
Mr. Jim Moore. Yeah, man.
Yeah, Jim.
He is the head of programs at SBL.
That's right.
He's the best, man. I love Jim.
Jim was talking about maybe even speaking a little bit about like how to build a way, you know, like how to explain how to use vocabulary when it comes to creating grooves and stuff like that. So I don't know. My hope is that like people show up with their basses and like we get into some cool discussions about these things. And I'm going to have supplemental materials to pass out. Like
amazing.
Probably the occasional PDF, maybe some tracks, which are only going to be distributed in the interest of fair use and things like that.
Yeah. All good. I mean, and here's, can I make a request? Because I want to come to the workshop as well.
Yeah, sure.
You did a course, I think maybe with True Fire, about like on Prince grooves, didn't you?
Well, okay. So True Fire had me do – those guys are great, by the way. They do mostly guitar stuff, but they have a few bass courses. I did a course that was basically about funk.
Yes.
And like different grooves – and so I wrote something that was more of like a
Minneapolis Prince inspired.
Thing.
Yeah.
Prince inspired.
I mean,
yeah.
you just have, you know, I feel like a lot of people might know you for the like, like the groups of five, the slapping thing, the like real intense, like technical stuff. But people might know you for this as well. But if you don't out there, you, Steve Jenkins also has an incredible sense of pocket time. Like it's not just about fitting five into 4/4. Like you are also about pocket and groove. And I think what would be incredible too, I just want, selfishly, I want this from your program. So I'm speaking it to you and speaking it into the universe is like taking the rhythm sections that you love or, you know, the artists that you love talking, doing a couple of weeks on Michelle, doing a couple of weeks on James Brown, doing a couple of weeks on Prince and playing some of those grooves and talking about the things that you love about them, because that's how, you know, people are going to get hipped to that stuff.
Yeah.
So I hope that you do some of that too.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess I feel okay revealing this. Like we're going to talk about
this is the time to reveal it. It's all good. Yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So basically we're going to talk about everything from like James Brown to Herbie Hancock, like with Paul Jackson to Meshuggah.
Yes.
Because to me, that the connective tissue with all those things is rhythm.
Of course.
Is it our rhythm or is rhythm? I've been very self-conscious about some of the grammatical choices I make. Yeah. You
know, I didn't even think about it.
The connective tissue, our rhythm, is rhythm. I don't know. Anyway, yes. Everything from James Brown to Meshuggah, We might get into some other things like some odd time signatures. But amazing. There's a lot you can do with four, and there's a lot that confuses True. People with four. You know what I mean? Yes. Like, there's definitely one of those things where it's like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it'll be a fun way to explore looking at some of the more celebrated things or the highly influential things. Like, cause to me, like, you know, I mean, the other thing is like for maybe people, who have been alive for like the last, I don't know, however long, I don't want to do the math cause it's either going to out how old we are or how
it's fine.
But I think we've witnessed two really incredible seismic moments with rhythm. Mm. That if you ask musicians who they are influenced by, you hear these two things come up a lot, and that's J Dilla and Meshuggah. Yes, doesn't even matter what genre yes. they're in. Like, doesn't you know? Matter. Like, I know jazz musicians that like love J Dilla, of course, but they're like, mm-hmm. dude, I really like Meshuggah, and it's yep. you know what I mean. And I think these are all things that have kind of woven their way into the zeitgeist.
Yes,
and absolutely. Even if people aren't playing, like metal, or they're not playing, you know, hip hop influenced stuff, just the idea of placement, you know, just the way that got introduced into the whole thing,
yes,
you know, it's right. it's such a profound thing. I mean, I remember I didn't understand what that was at first. You know, I didn't understand like how to recreate it live. Like, I eventually learned how, but you know, that just that having the ability to kind of think about placement, you know, I think the
it's
one thing,
huge.
Yeah. The one thing that I really think is, yeah, and it's like a lot of the other people who have done interviews and masterclasses talk about this. Like, you know, I mean, the one thing is like, you might think that like maybe someone like me might have different things to say about playing grooves than someone like a Sean Hurley or something. Mm. But dude, it's the same thing. It's always right. note lengths. It's note lengths and articulation
yes.
and sound, you know? But then there's also the X factor.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I sure do.
There's the X factor, which could be yeah. like, you know, the feel of it. You know, like sure. what's happening feel-wise, what changes when it's that kind of thing. But that's really it. I mean, I don't want to like oversimplify what being a rhythm section musician is or what being any kind of musician is, but essentially what determines the impact of something besides like the use of space is like note length and articulation.
Absolutely. Yes. And like the distance between your syncopations, right? Like, and that's, you know, people talk about feel, and sometimes I want people to say like, define that. And so many people can't, but what I think of, like when I think of feel, it's like, it's not just the note placement, autonomous note placements. It's how the note placements feel within each other as it relates yeah. to a pulse, right? Whether it's a click or whether, you know, whoever is sort of keeping the pulse, whether it's the upright bass player in a swinging thing, or if it's like, right. you know, a drummer in a more pop, rock, funk, whatever tradition. But I'm so excited about that because I think about this stuff a lot. I definitely get called to do like sonic based things more probably than I get called to do like really super heavy pocket oriented stuff. But I think about rhythms and pocket and feel all the time. And I, you know, it's a big, big deal to me. It's yeah. a big part of how I play. It's what I think makes the sounds work, right?
Yeah.
Like without putting them in the right place, the sound is irrelevant. Like yeah. it's a sound combined with what you said, right? Like articulation, note length, feel. And I can't wait to hear you do that, man. I think like for everybody out there, we're, but I'm not sure when this podcast is going out, but January 15th, we're launching this thing called Live Class, which is going to be an interactive sort of small group set of streams. There's going to be three a day, 5 days a week, maybe even 6 days a week. What day are you teaching, Steve?
My first
Do you know
one,
off the top?
I actually do because I look at my calendar a lot these days.
Yeah.
the 19th, Friday the 19th is when
okay,
my
Okay, so are you on Fridays? Like, are you teaching consistently on Fridays?
Fridays.
Oh, dude.
And,
sweet.
And I think my time slot is 10 a.m. Pacific time.
Got it. And so here's the thing, you guys, like, you can come and study with Steve at this. And this is different than the mentors thing that we've done, which is there's like a chat. People look at the chat, right? But you can have your base and Steve can be breaking down what Meshuggah is doing on New Millennium Cyanide Christ, or breaking down right. what, you know what I mean? Like what Pino is doing on the Voodoo record, on Chicken Grease or whatever, right? And you can then say, hey, Steve, what about this thing? And Steve will say, well, and answer you. That's the thing is, like, sometimes this shit is so mysterious
right.
that it's difficult. Like when you're listening to music by yourself or trying to play, you're like, I don't know. Am I nailing it? Am I not? Like, especially when you're starting out, you're like, I don't even know how to approach this. And that's something, that's what live class will give you, is a way to interact with an educator that is a monster that will tell you, that will just say, oh, try this. Put your hands here and lay back a little bit when you play that 16th note articulation. And then you'll go like this. And they'll go, yeah, that's a little closer. And you're like, oh my God. It's something that maybe you haven't had ever, unless you went to music school or unless you took private lessons. But next to having someone in the room with you, this is going to be the next best thing. So dude, I'm pumped that you're part of it. Thanks for doing it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, man. It's going to be fun. I think the idea is to try to also leave time. The hours don't really, you know, hours fly by, like an hour long thing. So I'm going to try to, as the weeks go on, try to leave some time for Q&A, because I do think there's going to be things that people may have questions of. And I also want to try to leave some room for, you know, like any discussions people might want to have. But yeah, the idea is hopefully to run it more like a class or like a, Berkeley, we called them labs. Like people would sit around, and I actually really like that term, because it just sounds like you're just kind of in there working it out, trying to see what happens. Like what happens when
you're
in
the lab.
Yeah. What happens when I put oxygen with, I don't know. I don't have a, I removed my periodic table from my wall years ago, but,
you know, man. Like hydrogen, maybe a little water.
Yeah. A little bit of water. Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's the idea, just to have it be, I don't know how many people, let me ask you this. Like I'm might be out of pocket.
Never.
As far as that goes, but like, how big are these classes?
Well, we don't know yet.
All right.
And whenever this comes out, like we're going to, like if it's past January 15th, you guys, we're going to know. We're not actually going to open, we're not going to start talking about it in marketing until January 15th. So probably the first week will be very low, because we're not, you know, we're not actually advertising it. But then I think it'll pick up. The idea is small group. The idea is that there's so many offerings, and it's three times a day. This will all be archived as well, right? So if you miss one of Steve's things where he's talking about James Brown, you could, it will be in the archive, which is so cool. So you can, there's going to be freaking endless content. It's crazy. But the idea is it will be fairly small group. Like we're not thinking, oh, there's going to be 300 people on this, because that will then negate the ability to ask, everyone gets to ask a question. The dream for me is 8 people. That's the dream. I want there to be 8 people on a stream. Now, we're going to have times where there might be nobody, right? Like no one might show up, and you just can't let that hit your ego. Like I know that I'm going to be doing my, you know, like my live practice sessions, and there'll be a week where like no one shows up. But there might also be a week where there'll be 200 people that show up, and that will be also interesting to try to figure out how to do it. So we're diving in. We're not sure, but the idea is that it will be fairly small, and that's okay. Like we're not expecting, whoa, like it's going to be this crazy, because it's expensive enough too. I think for a year, I mean, I think it's an amazing value, to be honest. But you can get in. The introductory price is going to be $4.99 for a year. And I mean, like just thinking about if you took an online class with one of these people, like you're paying that so soon. Like, you get access to all of these people for a year for $500. Wild. Yeah. And I think
it's a pretty good deal.
It's a pretty good deal. I mean, truly, you know, and I don't, you know, I'm like, I'm biased, right? Because I work there, but I do think it's a pretty good, But I really do think it's a good deal. When Scott told me, I was like, that's not enough money. Like, I think that's like too cheap. And he's like, yeah, we're going to do that for founding members that get in early. But then if you don't get in early, I think it'll be somewhere between like $700 and $1,000 for a year. So if this sounds like something that you want to do out there, get in early, get in, you know, the first week or two of January, and you'll lock in the $499 a year rate. You get that as long as you continue to be in the program, which is pretty cool. And again, if you don't have access to music school or to a teacher that you can bring things to and get direct feedback, live class will absolutely be the next best thing, and maybe even better because there's more perspectives. Scott's doing stuff. I'm doing stuff. Steve's doing stuff. Danny Mo Morris, Daisy Pepper is going to do a rock class. She's going to show you how to play like Deftones on a Spectre. So badass. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, oh, it's going to be so fun. So, you know, Todd Johnson with Beginner Jazz, Gary Willis is going to be doing a stream every week. Advanced jazz. Like, would you, I would have died for that as a kid. Died.
Yeah. Dude, I'm like, such a fan.
Just go study with Gary every week.
Yeah. I'm such a fan. Like, I went through a real heavy phase of like transcribing and like learning a lot of that stuff. And, you know, cause that's a big part of my thing also. But dude, when I was at Berkeley, this is in the '90s, there was this club that you couldn't, really, you'd have to take the sub, like Boston has the T, like that subway. You'd have to take this subway ride out to where Tufts University is, like Somerville. And they played at this place called Johnny D's, which is no longer there. I ended up playing there years later, but I was like 17 years old, man. And like, so you had to be 21 to get in. And I just remember, like, if anyone watching this who's, I know no one likes to hear like back in the day shit or like, but really the only way to watch someone do what they do, you had two options. You had instructional videos and you had to go see them live. You know, Gary's got like a ton of cool things he's posted. Like you can kind of see like a bird's eye view of his technique and stuff, but like literally it's like, you got to see these, you'd have to go see people live. So I was like hell bent with the power of 1,000 suns into that show. And they were like, nah, you know, and it was like, nah, sorry, kid. You know, like the boss, which I'm not doing so great. Sorry, kid. You can't get into the bar, you know? And I'm look, man, I'm not even trying to drink. I'll just drink Cokes all night. Like I'll buy food. Just, I want to watch them play. And so I had to kind of watch Tribal Tech from the corner of this bar. Like I was someone's kid, but it was awesome, man. And, then there was like another year where, and this is a weird lesson in musician economics. And I hope Gary doesn't mind me talking about this because he may not remember it, but I got a buddy that toured with Tribal Tech. I'm not going to tell his story. This drummer named Steve Wolf, who's an amazing musician. But anyway, one year, cause they seem to play Johnny D's like every year.
Yeah.
And, I was still not of age. So I went out there and I saw them roll up in this white Ford Econoline van.
Yeah.
And, I walked in with them and I said, can you guys like help me get in? Cause like I'm underage and last year was a real pain in the ass, but the show was killing. And they're like, yeah. So I paid my cover and they just said, look, he's a friend of the band. Let him watch. Fine. What I didn't realize, cause my thing was like, oh, they must've rented this white Ford Econoline van from the airport when they flew in from LA to play in Boston.
Yeah.
Wrong. They drove that fucking van all around the States.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Right.
And
yeah, it was never, like low budget. Yeah.
Yeah. Like they're on a label too, but it was like never thought to ask what the nature of the van was. Like, was this just something you got at Logan Airport that they like, hey, we need to get to the gig from the airport? Like, just didn't know how it worked at all.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, man. Yeah. You know, and they were doing it because they loved to do it, not for the piles and piles of cash that they were probably not really making.
That was such an interesting year when I went to school to see music. Like, the other thing was, this just shows you how much stuff has changed. Like, I remember reading in Bass Player magazine about Victor Wooten's favorite bass player. Mm. And that happened to be Oteil Burbridge. I had this friend who lived on my floor in the dorms, and he was like into like Fish and jam bands in the den. He's like, "Yo, man, Colonel Bruce Hampton and Aquarium Rescue Unit's playing at the Paradise tonight. That's Victor Wooten's favorite bass player." I was like, "Yeah, I was just reading about him." He's like, "Yeah, man, I'm going. You want to go?" I'm like, "Yeah." Went to the show. The band that went on before them, there was like a drummer with a gigantic drum kit. There was a guy that played saxophone, a guy that played violin, and this dude who played guitar and sang. Oh, and it was the Dave Matthews Band. And yeah, they opened for him, or maybe they,
holy crap,
maybe they chose to go first. But
yeah,
what was interesting was there was like just, it was packed. And I'm guessing most people were there for DMB because like it got a little bit thinner crowd wise as the night went on. But
yeah,
that was the first time I'd ever heard Dave Matthews Band. So it was like a really interesting,
wild. Yeah. And just such a different time, right? You had to actually go out and do it. And and it's interesting. I mean, it's still incredible to go out and do it. You guys go out and see bands, go out and see your artists. But also, if you want to learn some stuff about the bass.
Right. Sorry, I derailed us.
No, it's cool. I mean, it's amazing. But yeah, you had to do that work. You had to really be invested in doing that work. And you still can do that. Right. But there's some other ways to do it now too, which is pretty cool. And I really appreciate that. I'm thrilled. I'm going to come along. I'm going to try to be there on some of your sessions to see you do this stuff and talk about it because I have things to learn.
And, likewise, man.
It's going to be fun. If you want to come and hang out, I'm going to do a gear deep dive and I'm going to do practice sessions or like a live practice session where we start out. It's going to be 45. So we're going to do 15, 15, 15, doing timekeeping stuff, super simple, slow tempo, whole note, half note, quarter note, eighth note, like at 40, that kind of stuff. Move that into a theoretical thing, something simple, maybe inversions up C, right? You know, like all the different ways to play a triad, different inversions. And then the last 15 will be something about combining those two concepts, making a groove out of what we've just done, going around the room, having people unmute, show me your groove. It's going to be that kind of thing. So timekeeping, theoretical, creative. And that's how I like to structure my practice sessions when I am like a good boy and adhering to some kind of structure and not just being an asshole and, you know, slapping the bass or whatever. So it should be a good time. So pop by anytime. It'd be amazing to have you there.
What time is yours?
I'm on Wednesdays. So I'm doing that on, I believe, a Wednesday morning. And then I'm doing a gear deep dive later in the day on Wednesday. So I've got a heavy Wednesday, but it'll be a good time. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, that sounds great, man. That sounds fun. I'm stoked to see
should
it.
Should be good.
I'm going to try to see everybody's.
I know, me too.
Try being like, a fly on the wall.
Yeah, I just want to like go to all of these. Like, I'm excited to be a student at it as well. So, man, hey, thank you for your time and your just like generous spirit and vulnerability and monstrosity and perspective. You're awesome. Thanks.
Oh, man,
for
thank
doing
you.
This today.
And the feeling is mutual, man. I appreciate you having me do this. It's great to chat. Great to catch up, man.
Absolutely.
Are you going to be doing the NAMM show thing in a couple weeks?
I'll be at NAMM.
I'll be there.
Oh, I'll see you there. I'm going to be there with Sharon doing stuff for SBL. But then I think I might be doing something with Lull and also with Spectre.
Oh, hell yeah, man.
So it should be a good time.
I'll be there. I'm not sure if I'm doing anything with anyone, but you know, you'll know where to find me based on the brands we've discussed.
It'll be great. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it, man.
Cool. Awesome, man.
Okay. Hey, take care everybody. We'll catch you in the next one.
Cool. See y'all later.